Right. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the second panel of your morning. I think the coffee is starting to kick in, and we're all ready to keep engaging. So today's panel is on fuel and fleet strategies driving the shipping energy transition. Our discussion today could not be more relevant. As the maritime industry navigates complex regulatory landscapes, technological achievements, advancements, and shifting market dynamics in the pursuit of, as discussed earlier, decarbonization. I'm privileged to have with us an esteemed panel of industry leaders, each of whom plays pivotal roles in shaping the future of shipping, both with their companies and through their leadership in key industry organizations. Their insights will be invaluable as we explore how fleets are adapting, how fuel strategies are evolving, and how industry organizations are working to drive this transformation forward. Let me first introduce our distinguished panelists. First, Mr. Hing Cao, Executive Chairman of Wang Quang Maritime Transport Holdings and co-founder and chairman of the Hong Kong Chamber of Shipping. Mr. Cao, welcome and thank you for being here. Mr. Paulus Hajiwanu, CEO of Safe Bulkers and Vice President of the Cyprus Union of Ship Owners. Paulus, great to have you with us today. Mr. Miki Koshinen, Managing Director, ESL Shipping, and Vice President of the European Community Ship Owners Associations. Mr. Koshin, thank you. And last, Mr. Mark O'Neill, President and CEO of Columbia Group and former President of the Intermanager. Mark, it's a pleasure to have you here today. So the title of our panel today consists of two key elements, fleet strategies and fuel strategies. So I'd like to structure our discussion accordingly. Let's begin by focusing on the fleets that you own, manage, operate. Each of you leads a company that is navigating this transition in its own way, implementing strategies to enhance efficiencies, reduce emissions, and future-proof operations. Paulus, I'd like to start with you. At Safe Bulker, you operate a high-quality, fuel-efficient fleet of 46-plus bulk carriers, with new building projects also in the pipeline. What strategies have you implemented to drive the energy transition? What has been the most effective, and are there areas where you face challenges or see more room for improvement?
Thank you very much. I think at Safe Bulkers we started relatively early with the energy transition of our fleet because we saw, being a public company, you get the alerts much earlier than the private companies. So we started early, first of all, in 2018 by ordering for half of our fleet the so-called scrubbers, which we moved early and installed them before the end of 2019 on some 25 ships. And after that, we start focusing during the start of the COVID on how we will upgrade the existing fleet. So we started from 2021, applying on every ship that was going on dry dock, the low friction paints, the ducts, and all the other things that are giving us the opportunity now in a very bad market for dry bulk to stay profitable and manage to get those investments paid back already. So after that, we moved, of course, into the phase three new buildings, which is mostly done to prepare the company towards the 2030 goals that we cannot achieve by just doing the upgrading of the existing fleet. So we're in a good track right now, and I'm pleased that we've started early and we have good support now in the loan market.
Thank you, Paulus. Very interesting and quite a lot of activity for sure. Mr. Cao, Wang Quang operates a diverse, modern, and safety-focused fleet. How is your team approaching this transition? What strategies have been most successful? And have you observed differences in how various vessel types adapt to new technologies?
First of all, it's a pleasure once again to be in Athens. I'm always happy to be participating in Capital Link. In response to your question, I can answer it with a five-pronged approach. In my view, this is a knowledge-driven process. So the first step is we have a strong focus on research. As we are navigating this transition, a lot of technologies are completely new. What works, what doesn't work, as you said, what works on what type of ships, on what type of routes, all of that require research. So since about 4 or 5 years ago, we started working very closely together with partners, shipyards, design institutes, equipment suppliers, as well as classification society, and of course, constantly exchanging notes with other fellow ship owners, etc., to understand where the development of the technology are, what is more promising. So reverse focus is very much the first step. And within Wakwong, over the last 24 months, we have now developed a specialized division called Venture Marine Services, completely focused on decarbonization and on new smart technology. So I have a team of people looking at this 24 hours. The second step is building competencies, because not only are we looking at a new landscape of regulations, technologies, fuel solutions, and supply chain, but you also need people on land and at sea working these machinery, working these new ships. So we have been building up our competencies both onshore and on land. I'll give you some example. So Wakwong is the first technical manager of LNG bunkering ships in China. We are also the manager of China's first and one of the world's first methanol bunkering ship. So at this moment in time, Wakwong is very, very comfortable handling with alternative fuels. At the same time, we are the first company in conjunction with China Merchants in China to work with Dalian Maritime University to develop a framework for training for LNG crew. So developing competencies for future seafarers, as well as getting our team, technical team, ready, it's something that is very important to us. The third part is optimization. First of all, design optimization. At this moment in time, asset prices are very high, and as one of the speakers in the previous panel has said, we're also in a high-cost environment, and market's not looking so good, particularly in dry bulk. So that being the case, how can we optimize existing ships and using better design? That's very, very important. I'll give you an example. During COVID, Wakwong, together with our partners in class, we engaged some Chinese shipyards, one of them being the New Dalian, which is very well-known to the Greek market, from what is called a 63-plus crown design. We have now redesigned this ship to a cargo capacity, nearly 65,000 deadweight ton, which not only becomes the first Ultramax of the design to fulfill EEDI3, but it's reaped a lot of dividends in terms of sales globally. So design optimization is very important. Related to that is smart technology, because as, again, previous panelists have already said, how to optimize existing assets are extremely important, and we have embraced technology change, not only with environmental tech, but also smart technology. So we have worked very closely with Classification Society to pioneer the development of smart notations, and every single new ship that Wakwong builds is smart enabled. The fifth dimension is what has commonly been called technical interventions, dual fuel being one of the solutions, but not the only one. And to give you some examples of how different vessel types, different trade routes have impact or may not be relevant to particular technologies. If we look at wind, for example, we know that ships sailing on east to west axis works much better on north to south axis. If we look at air lubricator, obviously, if you have less of a draft, that works better. So there are lots of nuances. I cannot elaborate because I'm taking up too much time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chow. Very, very good, strong answer. Lots of things to look at and consider. Moving now over to Mr. Koskinen, ESL Shipping has a strong Nordic and Baltic presence, and your fleet transformation is very evident. What are the core elements of your energy transition strategy? What initiatives have you worked well, and where do you see opportunities for further optimization?
We, of course, have as a starting point the nature we have in the Nordics. We have the winter season and the ice we as well have to tackle. We started our decarbonization journey 10 years ago, basically by optimizing the existing fleet, upgrading, training the crew, checking what can be done operationally. And actually, this is something we all should not forget. We have been able to save more than 25% on fuel and emissions by making new agreements with the customers, starting virtual arrival, just-in-time concept with most of the bulk cargo we are carrying nowadays, So there's a lot you can do even without the investment. Then, of course, we have looked on various technologies, and in 2015 we already placed our first LNG-fueled bulk carrier orders. The ships delivered in 2018, they are still will be 20% below the EEDI-3 requirements of this year in 25. So I think we did a magnificent job already 10 years ago in this respect. We have also decided to electrify most of the fleet we are running. We are running geared vessels as well. And we see big potential in sort of holistic energy saving when we are introducing battery packs on board and we are taking the back power from the cranes, for example, back to the operation of the vessel. We are also using the power packs to peak shaving during the transit. And the results so far have been quite promising. And I believe that that the electrification of any vessel we have in the fleet will continue. Then the latest step, of course, has been that we have ordered methanol dual-fueled vessels to be delivered in a couple of years of time. We have, as a company, committed to science-based targets, meaning that by 2040 we will need to be net zero in emission. And we have a large customer basis partly willing to commit to the same path. And I think really, we will speak later about this, but the vital component really is to get the customer on board. We need to share the same vision for the low emission transportation. Unless the clients are committed, we will not succeed. We need their support. We need stronger partnerships as an industry. We need longer contracts in order to facilitate the offtake agreements of the new green fuels. We will not survive without the support from the clients.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Now over to Mark. Columbia Group is a large, diversified global player in vessel management and operations. How are you and your team strategically positioning the group for this transition? What has been most effective? And is there anything that, in hindsight, you would have approached maybe differently? Mark?
Yes, good morning, and thanks, Ezekiel, and thanks to Nicholas as well, and Capital Link for putting on another wonderful event. Look, as a supplier of maritime integrated maritime services, we have to remain client-facing at all times, and we have to remain competent and relevant, and keep to that, quality competence side end of the spectrum. So we have to be aware of all of these issues as they develop. I personally am fascinated that we are 1 hour 15 minutes into Capital Link Athens, the heart of world shipping, and we have only alluded to Trump once, and I don't think the word Trump has actually been stated. And I think Trump, President Trump, is the 600-pound silverback sitting in the room. And equally important is his vice president, because whoever I talk to in the States, and we're talking about strategy here and how we strategize for the future, so we have to bear this in mind. Whoever I talk to, friends in the States, say that, you know, 160 people voted for this president, and this is not a flash in the pan. This is not likely to be a one-term wonder. This is likely to be, there's likely to be a successor in his vice president. So we have to formulate our strategy going forward accordingly. The ESG narrative is being changed by the day, by the minute. We're seeing orders, a flurry of orders are coming out. And I wonder to what extent Drill Baby Drill is compatible with all of the talk that we're hearing, particularly in Europe, on alternative fuels and decarbonization. Where is the interchange, as the Americans would call it, between Drill Baby Drill and decarbonization and alternative fuels? We have to grapple with this issue. We cannot keep our heads stuck in the sand and pretend life goes on as normal, because otherwise we're going to end up with a rude awakening. I think we're seeing the established world order and the established world intelligent thinking being ripped up and trampled on, as I said, minute by minute, and we really have to try and formulate our positions in that new scenario. To what extent does this sort of carpet bombing of what we had before survive? Do alternative fuels, are alternative fuels realistic, a realistic alternative going forward, where drill baby drill presumably means drill carbon fossil fuels more, and that these fuels will play an increasingly important part in our future? So where does that sit with efficiencies? Where does that sit with optimizations and reducing carbon? Personally, personal view, I don't think that the exchange, the exchange between drill baby drill and decarbonization lies in alternative fuels. I think it lies in tech. Because if tech can get us to a reduced carbon, but still drill baby drilling, oil, etc., and gases, carbon fuels, then tech is probably the solution for the 600-pound gorilla in the room, and that's probably what he would like. So I think we're probably distilling all of that down. Our strategy is hedge, baby, hedge. And looking at all of these things and being very aware that there has been a mighty seismic shift in the alternative fuels decarbonization debate that we must realize. And please, you know, we all have to be not only adaptive, as we heard in the first panel, but incredibly flexible going forward. We cannot be that VLCC that takes 10 kilometers to slow down. We have to be a very nimble, rigid hull inflatable that can change at a moment's notice when a flurry of executive orders come. And to do that, we really have to keep our eyes very much open and perhaps be slightly more realistic that there is a changed environment in shipping and all other sectors.
Mark, thank you very much. Very interesting comments. The silverback gorilla, we have to remember that one for sure. And it ties into nicely, though, to our next series of questions here, which is really on fuel strategies and the role of regulation. Turning to fuel strategies, this is the topic that is been discussed for a long time. It's still at the core of shipping, of decarbonization, of decisions that we're trying to make. I'll fall back a little bit before the beginning of this year to 2024. We saw significant developments. At least I feel this way, particularly with the increased adoption of LNG dual-fuel vessels, especially among major liner companies. However, questions remain about the long-term viability, regulatory developments, and infrastructure challenges. Looking ahead at 2025, how do you see fuel adoption evolving? How are the current regulations and supply chain dynamics shaping decision-making? And I'll head to Mr. Koshinen first. Let's start with you and how ESL shipping is positioning itself in terms of fuel choices.
I think we are talking about an issue that is on a much more sort of broader level than only on company level. We would need stability, long-term regulatory framework to be in place in order to place the investment correctly. And I think we are partly missing it. We have the regulatory framework in Europe now. It was a bit disappointing to hear Mark's news on the current realities of the world. However, I think we should bear in mind that we, in this room, we only have one planet. Maybe Elon Musk has another one in sight, but we only have the one, and I think we should take better care of it than only drill, baby drill type of approach. I think what we need is a systemic approach also for the new fuels. They are not available for the time being, even if also we are investing into vessels capable of using them. The investments required are billions of euros or dollars for the production of the fuels. It was interesting to hear in the previous panel that there are doubts that electricity might not be available. I think it will be available. I think we will have vast amounts of cheap wind power and solar power energy available in the future years. And I believe, ladies and gentlemen, actually these renewables will be cheaper to produce and to use than the fossil fuel. I think we are making a huge mistake globally if we ought to go back to the old, whereas we have the possibility of building a huge supply of green renewable energy by the wind power and solar. And that can be used on a large scale for the production of the clean fuels, be that ammonia or e-methanol. We have a fantastic possibility. We just need to go and grab the opportunity. But for that purpose, I think we need to have the regulatory framework also in place. And this is what EXA as well is driving. We all know that the EU ETS, the system is collecting a huge amount of money that is piling into the pockets of European Union member states and also the Union itself. We estimated that when in full force, the system will create about 9 billion euros annually. And ladies and gentlemen, I think it's worth to say that we deserve the money back to the industry. We need the money to speed up the green transition and to narrow the price gap between the fossil fuel and the green fuel. We don't have to stick to the Stone Age policies of the US. We can actually create our own world, maybe a better and alternative world. Fine, let us deregulate a little bit so that life on everyday level become a bit more easy. But I think we have a fantastic future with renewable electricity, with the new fuels, if we play it right. But we need to put the stakes in the right places, and we need the funds collected back to the industry.
Thank you. Very, very good comment and very interesting as well. I'll head over to you again, Mark. You've touched on it a bit there earlier, but you can continue with Colombia's approach towards alternative fuels. I think agility was the key, but I'll let you take it from there.
Thank you. Yeah. I think our approach to alternative fuels is our client's approach to alternative fuels, and we have to, as I said, be client-facing at all times. That said, I think it is likely that HFO will be the dominant burnt fuel for the foreseeable future. And as Dr. Bornheim stated at the beginning, we simply will not have the capacity of alternative fuels or the capability to provide alternative fuels to the worldwide fleet in remote parts of the world where that fleet trades. So that HFO will have to be the dominant solution for the foreseeable future. And that ties in, of course, doesn't it, with drill, baby, drill. I think that doesn't rule out a net zero or a reduced carbon future. But I think the solution to decarbonization lies in tech. The car industry, get it. Other sectors of industry, get it. They're already developing carbon stripping, carbon reduction, carbon capture technology. The automobile industry is already talking about optionality. President Trump has said he wants to give clients or voters what they want. If you want to buy a petrol car, you buy a petrol car, but it may have carbon capture technology or carbon stripping technology, where obviously we have a duty, as Mickey said, to reduce the carbon. So I think tech is the likely solution in this new environment. Will there be a proliferation of alternative fuels given the new drill baby drill approach? I don't think so. Given the lack of availability for the foreseeable future, I don't think so. Given the cost of the infrastructure, I don't think so. Certain companies, liner companies, trading between dedicated ports will have that availability of alternative fuels, but the vast majority of us won't. So I think we will have to have a flexible approach, and we'll have to invest some of these billions that would otherwise go into the infrastructure for alternative fuels into tech. And as I said, that looking, we need to raise our eyes above the parapet sometimes and look at other industries that are seeing this and are developing. But very interesting, some of the comments on biofuels from the previous panel. I think certainly HFO, biofuel future with alternative fuels on the periphery and tech assisting seems to be the way going forward.
Thank you, Mark. Over to Mr. Chow. With Wakwong's diverse fleet, how are you evaluating the fuel choices amid the evolving regulations and the discussed supply chain constraints?
I'll go with your question, and then I'll try to look at the question slightly differently. To go with your question, first of all, we, based on research, do an assessment of the current energy efficiency, or, to put it a different way, the carbon emission of our existing fleet and the new ships that we're going to build. So that's the first thing. Secondly, it's understanding the regulations and regulatory framework and the direction of travel. At this moment in time, as we all know, we are poised for a very important year where the IMO may make a global announcement about the future, which may come out of MEPC 83, or it may come out later on in the year. If we are to trust the personal comments made by the Secretary General on different occasions, he has said that some sort of a global framework may come into place within this year. May not be in April, but perhaps sometime in the year. So I think this is definitely the major driver for alternative fuels or the pathway forward, because economics will be the primary driver as to which fuel may become more attractive than others in the decarbonization journey forward. The third layer is understanding supply chain. I've heard different speakers today expressing pessimism about the development of global supply chain. I take a different view. Sitting in China, I see a lot of projects in the pipeline. Many of them are actually waiting for the market conditions. So indeed, it is a chicken and egg situation. But once we have a clearer set of regulations, once we know the way to actually certify what actually qualifies as green fuel or clean fuel, and whether a certain amount of blending, because we know whether we're looking at methanol or ammonia, to take two examples, whether it's green, brown, gray, blue, the molecules are exactly the same. So if there's a bit more intelligence, in my view, built into the regulation, this could make clean fuel a bit more viable in the near future, not in the distant future. So I would say regulations is the driving force at this moment in time. That is to go with your question. To go sort of look at it slightly differently, I completely agree with Mark's earlier comment that technology is not flat. What was impossible yesterday has become not only possible, but widely available today. Green electricity's prices have dropped significantly. In certain countries like China, green electricity is on par with ordinary electricity. If that is something that could be replicated through global partnerships around different parts of the world, could green fuels or clean fuels become more viable? Perhaps, but perhaps there are also other ways. In China, we're talking about circularity, the circular economy of carbon itself. We must not forget that the idea is not to eliminate carbon use, because carbon is actually good for us. Carbon has brought millions upon millions of people out of poverty. It's how we use carbon in a very destructive industrial manner. That's destructive to Earth. That's destructive to the future of mankind. That is the enemy, not carbon itself. So if we can use carbon more intelligently, and if technology has a role to play, why not?
Very interesting, Mr. Chow. Very interesting. Jumping over to Paulus from Safe Bulkers, how's your perspective for the fuel landscape evolving, and what are your expectations in 2025?
Yes, regarding the philosophy of our company, at least, is very basic. We think that you should be doing something ahead of the game, but to a certain extent, and then see how it develops. We ordered 18 months ago dual fuel methanol Kamsarmaxes with Tsuneishi Shipyard. The ships are under construction right now, and they will be delivered in about a year's time, starting a year's time. I know less today about what will be the fuel of the future and if I will have methanol available when the ships are delivered. I thought I knew more 18 months ago, so things are not developing as fast as we would like, or I don't believe ship owners we will have in our hands the tools we will need, the bankers. I don't know if this will be available in 2030. Maybe some of it will be available for the large liner companies, which they have ordered 20,000 TEU vessels, tens of them, or 30, 40, 50 units each, They will take everything else, everything that is coming on available, whether this is gray or green methanol, and I doubt if we will be finding any methanol for the dry bulk owner of a couple of ships. Also, on top of that, we are facing another burden which we imposed on ourselves with all the regulation that is hitting us at the same time in a long market. Right now, in dry bulk, which is not tanker business, is not container business, which is thriving, we have to do the accountant, to be the accountant for the collection of the EU ETS. Right now, we have ships fixed with operators at 15,000 that the operator is earning 5,000. You have to do the chasing for people to reimburse you the EU ETS. So we're doing the collector, the tax collector, you may call us anything you want. But this is a very, very slow process. So at the end of the, when we have to pay those for 2024 to the authorities, I doubt if more than 80% of our charters would have paid this to us. So we will be chasing around, we will have to pay it, and we will be chasing around for the rest. So we must be more clever when the global standard comes from the IMO, how this will be passed to the commercial operator, and how the owner who cannot collect from an inferior charterer and charter will not be willing to pay it back, how we will be able to collect it. So these are things that in the good market we never care about, and we believe that the charterer will always pay those things. I'm afraid that this will not be the scenario. We have right now those who are in the dry bulk, a very bad market, a very low market. It's a market that's greatly affected by the talk of imposition of tariffs between the major economies of the world. This will lead in a disaster of how all this will be collected. Our methanol ships, I don't think we'll have better employment than the non-methanol ships for the first 2-3 years. So what we are doing as a company is at least we are improving the efficiency of our existing ships. We cannot use wind, as Mr. Chow said, on bulkers because they are going in so many small ports around the world. Wind, which is free, of course, is coming from God and from the seas. We cannot use it on bulkers because medium-sized bulkers could not enter ports. They will decline them at terminals in Australia, in the US, here, there. So it's more for this sort of technologies is more available for contract ships that they have a certain COA carrying maybe, I don't know, from West Australia to China, and you get the permit from 3 loading ports and 3 discharging ports, and you can do this employment. So ourselves, we are using digital technology. We're using a very good Greek company, which I also see here today, for getting all the information from our ships in the office and trying to optimize those. We are using the previous things I mentioned, the paints, the ducts, and all these things. We are making the investment, but in the dual fuel, I have my doubts if this decade we will get any benefit out of it.
Thank you, Paulus. And thank you for the first couple of rounds of questions. I'd like to quickly shift gears and have our panelists put on a little bit of different hats. Each of you have or are playing a leadership role in important industry shipping organizations. These associations represent diverse stakeholders and play a critical role in shaping policies, setting in standards, and facilitating collaboration. Let's discuss how these organizations are driving the energy transition. What strategies are they implementing? What has worked well, and where do the challenges remain? Mr. Chow, I'll go to you first. As the co-founder and chairman of the Hong Kong Chamber of Shipping, what are the organization's core priorities in leading this transition?
Okay, first of all, let me just say a few words about Hong Kong Chamber of Shipping. Hong Kong Chamber of Shipping is intended to be a hub to pull together supply chain partners. So we serve as a center around which the maritime ecosystem can come together. So members of this organization does not only include a traditional maritime players, shipping companies, ship associations, such as Hong Kong Ship Owners Association, but indeed also supply chain partners, energy companies. So for example, PetroChina and Sinopec, they are founding members of our organization. Significant port groups are also our partners. And one of the reasons that has on debt of setting up the Hong Kong Chamber of Shipping is because at this moment of difficult globalization, we think that as we're facing up to challenges of the magnitude of decarbonization, shipping itself cannot resolve our problems, as is well known to industry and expressed by different panelists, both here and in the previous panel. But indeed, we need to work with cross-sectoral partners. And that's what the Hong Kong Chamber of Shipping is about. One of our priorities at this moment in time is bringing together supply chain partners from electrification company, energy company, to companies that specialize in the production of hydrogen and green fuel, certification bodies, ports, bunkering companies, and shipping companies, to construct a full supply chain. And hopefully with if we're able to put together this demo in China, this is something that could be replicated in other parts of the world and show the way forward, because I am optimistic that something can be done. But we are in this chicken and egg scenario, and I think the more transparency we create in supply chain, the more we can aggregate both demand and supply, the more we can move the agenda forward. So that is one of the agenda we're focusing on, and I think for the global shipping community, that is perhaps the most pertinent point. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving quickly, time is running. Paulus, in your role as a Cyprus Union of Ship Owners.
Look, in, as Vice Chairman of Cyprus Union of Ship Owners, I'm receiving all this anxiety from our members of how they can be sure that the burden of payment of taxation, EU ETS, fuel EU, does not come to their shoulders. This is what they are worried about. They are worried about that that the commercial operator will find excuses to escape from their obligations. Take for example the fuel EU that is we are charging from the 1st of January of 2025. We are negotiating with every other charterer a new clause. They are coming and they are proposing clauses. We want this clause to apply. We don't accept BIMCO. We don't want to use this. We have our own standards. Big charterers, so each one is proposing a different clause. We go through our legal departments. If you are a listed company, okay, you are more organized and you can negotiate certain things. But a smaller owner, we are driving him out of business. There must be a global standard. There must be, I don't know why we are not thinking on the global level, on the IMO level, to be a charge on the bankers, the guy who pays for the bankers, the guy who buy the bankers, who pay for all these costs. Why to burden the owner more and more? We are interested in safety matters, in crewing shortages, in tariffs in the trade. We are driving European ship owners out of business. We have to. We don't want to make the ship owner the tax collector. We need to pass charges to the people, to the commercial operator, directly. Why for me to negotiate with this charterer a different clause for the fuel EU? Why the charterer to have a right to offset costs by buying and owners financing or by, I don't know, borrowing from next year to this year and all these complications. These are the things that are worrying ship owners, not necessarily the big liner companies or well-organized companies of 200 ships or 150 ships, but the owner of 10 ships, 20 ships, how he will manage to cope with all these things. So we are driving smaller Greek ship owners out of business. We have to address this issue and try to simplify matters, not to make them more complicated.
Thank you, Paulus. Over to Mark, as the former president of Intermanager.
Yes, very quickly. I think many of these associations, with the best intentions, sometimes pursue a course that they think is in the best interest of their members, and it isn't necessarily so. So I think all of these associations have to provide guidance to their members, but they have to provide relevant guidance in the best interests of their clients, having regard to circumstances and changing circumstances as we see now, so that we get away from this VLCC analogy or metaphor and get to the rigid hull inflatable. We have to be extremely nimble. I think all of these associations owe it to their members to be just that. And there's no time like the present for such nimbleness.
Thank you, Mark. And last but not least, to wrap up our panel for today, as we are running out of time, Mr. Koshinen, as the Vice President of ECSA, what are the key strategies in this organization pursuing?
To put it in short, I think EXA's priority is to retain competitiveness of shipping industry in Europe. Very clearly, we are requiring a level playing field in the competition against international flags. We must have a fit-for-purpose taxation and regulatory framework for the industries. All of you in this room, you have made shipping a true European success story. Whereas Europe stands for 15% of the world GDP, European owners are controlling 40% of the world commercial fleet. And really, we need to maintain the future of this success story. And there also, we need to bear in mind the very important matter is availability of competence for the ships and to the offices as well. And there the association is doing a really good job nowadays, highlighting the needs for education systems globally and all that. I think, to put it in short, we need to be competitive as an industry.
Thank you very much, and we are out of time, so I'll wrap it up with just by saying thank you to my panelists. Thank you for your insights and your candid perspectives. Clearly, the energy transition in shipping is still complex and evolving challenge, but it's also a tremendous opportunity for those who navigate it strategically. And my takeaways from this panel would be simply two words I heard that I think may jumpstart to 2025, and that is tech and investment. Thank you all.